I call Senate Resources to order. Today's date is Friday, March 15th. The time is 3:32 p.m. Committee members here today, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Michicki, Senator French, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator McGuire is excused today. We have a pretty full agenda today. We're going to start out with H.J.R. 5, Opposed Genetically Engineered Salmon. We did not have time for public testimony yesterday on that, Wednesday, and I have one person signed up in Cordova to speak on that, Mr. Jerry McCoon? He's here in person. All right, Mr. McCune, if you would identify yourself for the record. Since we do have quite a few people signed up to testify, I'm going to limit it to 1 minute.
I'll make this short, Madam Chair.
Very good. Go ahead and proceed.
My name is Jerry McCune. I represent Cordova District Fishermen United, and we've been on this issue from the very beginning. And we oppose it, as you heard from the sponsor. FDA is just being ridiculous on this whole issue. They've heard from over 2,000 people, and they don't seem to be responding. In fact, they even gave a grant to Aqua Bounty to keep them afloat because they almost went broke. So we're totally against their genetic modified fish. And if it comes down to where they do approve it, then we want it labeled. So we've been in this fight for a couple of years, and this resolution is timely right now because they extended the comment period in Washington, D.C. for 60 days. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes, Representative Tarr mentioned that the public testimony had been extended, or the public comment on this issue. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We do have another person on the off-net. This gentleman, had signed up to testify on Wednesday, and we weren't able to get to him. Heath Hilliard is in Anchorage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, and I represent the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, which is an organization comprised of charter fishing operators and lodge owners through Southeast Alaska. And I just wanted to call very briefly and offer our strong support for HGR5. As HGR5 refers to the FDA bill that's currently under consideration, we supported Senator Murkowski's amendment to that FDA bill last year, so this is very consistent with our position. So in light of the heavy schedule you have, I'll keep my remarks there.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Hilliard, for your testimony. And that looks like everyone who wished to testify. What are the wishes of the committee, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move to the bill from committee with fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Without objection, the bill will be passed out of this committee. HDR 5 will pass out of this committee. Let's hold off on signing the committee reports until after the meeting today so we can pack in as many public comments as we can on other bills. Senator Michicki?
Can I make a statement just very quickly?
A
very short one.
We've passed the bill out already, so
it was quick.
Go ahead.
That's okay. I can wait till next time.
All right. It will be heard on the floor next. It had only this one committee of referral.
Just my brief statement was that I have never, since this came to us several years back, have I ever heard a single statement of support for genetically engineered salmon? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Next bill on the docket is Senate Bill 60, Bounty on Sea Otters. And when we heard this bill on Wednesday, we were not able to complete public testimony here in the room. We had six folks signed up here in Juneau, and we were unable to complete that. We're going to get a list of folks that want to sign up or have signed up to testify here. Thank you. All right, so we've got six folks here. So the first person on the list is James Sullivan. If you'd come forward, Mr. Sullivan, and right after him will be Rosita Worrell. All right. Welcome, Mr. Sullivan. And for this bill, we'll confine it to 1 minute. If you would go ahead and introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is James Sullivan, and I represent the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak on SB 60. I'd like to start by saying SEAC strongly supports the right of Alaskan Natives to hunt sea otters for subsistence purposes and for the creating and selling of handicrafts and clothing, as Section 101B of the Marine Mammal Protection Act allows. But Senate Bill 60, as written, is in conflict with Section 109A of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. This section provides that no state may enforce or attempt to enforce any state law or regulation relating to the taking of any species of marine mammal within the state unless the Secretary has transferred authority for the conservation and management of that species to the state under Section 109B1. SB 60 is impermissible because the Secretary of the Interior has not granted the state management authority under 109B1 of the Act. And in closing, Madam Chair, regardless of how the bill is currently written and such, SEAC believes that ecosystem-based management reliant on the best available scientific information is the proper approach to ensure healthy and sustainable fisheries within the state of Alaska. And we just like to go on the record that we don't support any type of bounty system, however written. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sullivan. Rosita Worrell, welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm following the suit of our Senator
Zinnen
and bringing a sea otter for you.
Yes, and your beautiful soft vest.
Thank you. Thank you, noble people. Madam Chair and honorable committee members, I am Rosita Worrell. I'm the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. I'm also on the board of the Alaska Federation of Natives, and I serve as the chair of its subsistence committee. I'm also a Harvard-trained anthropologist. I've done 30 years of research throughout Alaska and the circumpolar Arctic, so I have a somewhat knowledge of subsistence. With me today are Lee Kadinger, our COO, and other members of our Sea Alaska Heritage Institute who are all wearing sea otter products. I have a written testimony that I am leaving for you, along with a report on SHI's cultural and economic sustainability through traditional arts that I will leave for you. It provides an outline of our sea otter project and offers a number of recommendations that could lessen the impacts on commercial and subsistence resources. First, may I say that I can appreciate the commercial, the impacts on the commercial fisheries that we've heard so much about. May I also say that our own tribal members are advising us of the impacts on our subsistence resources. However, I am concerned that this legislation is not the solution to the reported impacts. It could ultimately, if it were found to be legal and implemented, undermine our efforts to address the impacts in a positive way and possibly threaten a sustainable sea otter population. May I say from the onset that the harvests we are supporting will be well within the presently known scientific potential biological removal level. We depend on the data provided to us by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and our harvests are also initiated in areas that are identified to us by the Fish and Game Office. In addition, we are governed by our own traditional values of Ha'ani, Ha'shagun, and Ha'tlatsin. Ha'ani calls us for honoring and respecting the environment as we are utilizing the resources. Ha'shagun requires us to protect the environment and the resources for future generation. Ha'tlatsin teaches us to utilize our traditional knowledge and incorporate new or scientific knowledge into our practices. These values have sustained us for 10,000 years. Through the state of Alaska's support, SHI expanded its sustainable arts program to include sea otter. Basically, the project will support the harvest of 250 sea otters annually over a 3-year period. the tanning of sea otter hides in an Alaskan tannery, and the instruction of skin sewing to 50 individuals. We believe that this project can alleviate the impacts that are evident in our region while at the same time providing revenues to individuals in economically depressed communities and who often have no other alternative to gainful employment. It will also allow us to revive ancient traditions that were near extinction as a result of the decimation of the sea otter population under the Russian occupation. Mr. Kadinger can provide you further details on our project, but I wanted to show you one of the hats that was just made in one of our classes that was completed in cake.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm signed up as well later
on
the list. If you'd like me to go now, or I can come back up at that time.
How about right now, as long as you're here?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for your time today and the ability to testify on behalf of this. Although the bounty bill may not be the best vehicle, we do believe there are ways that the state of Alaska can help support various programs like our Sea Otter Project. One of the issues we've been having is with the definition significantly altered and what that means. Some federal agents will say that this hat is not considered significantly altered. That's one way to use State of Alaska's resources to help us clarify that these types of items that you see before us are significantly altered and can enter resale or can enter the retail market. Who would start a business if you are always in fear that you would be arrested for making a hat like this? And that's exactly what the situation is. We can also, with the fiscal note attached to this bill, I believe it's $280,000, we could expand the size of our project and enter further communities into the Aleutians up north, if need be, and throughout Southeast Alaska to make a more statewide presence. Finally, the third and last point would be to expand the marketing of sea otter products. From an economist standpoint, rather than pushing supply, we'd pull it. Through larger demand, more people interested in purchasing sea otter products would lead to more sustainably harvested sea otter. So.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. It's $28,000 for the fiscal note. Just a factor of another zero, you know, that's all. Any committee members with questions? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Ma'am, would the efforts that you are all are doing, and I think I understood 250 animals a year harvesting, are there areas of otter habitat here in Southeast that you all's efforts don't utilize?
Well, through the fish and game, they identified areas that they thought would be helpful to their fishermen and other people, and that was in the Petersburg area, Cake, POW, and then some in Yakutat, and we're not able to harvest in Glacier Bay, but, you know, some, and that population is growing, but the sea otter do come outside of Glacier Bay. We have concentrated primarily in Yakutat, and it's a matter of recruiting the hunters also. And so we've recruited hunters in Yakutat. We have not been as successful in Cake, where we should, you know, we'd like to have a little more hunters and more, I think, more harvest could be taken there, as well as in the POW area.
Follow-up?
Yeah, so you answered an important question I didn't ask, and that is you said you're getting your direction from Fish and Game. Arguably, they're telling you where there's an overpopulation and so on and so forth.
They're telling us where it's abundant.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. But you also said that there's a number of areas where your folks are not hunting at all. And so do you object to some other effort by some other folks, maybe even bounty hunters, doing what's required in the areas where you're not able to be a part of the management system?
Senator, for myself personally, I can't support bounty hunting. I think it has to be put into a program that, you know, provides, and it would violate the law if you just went out and shot the otters and didn't do anything with them. there has to be some use of it. That's according to the federal law and also according to our own traditional values. So I couldn't support that, Senator.
And one more follow-up then. In the area, region I'm in, beavers are causing a lot of harm to fish rearing grounds. Fish and Game said that they let people go trap there, but the hides aren't worth enough to make it economic for people to go do that. So there are people that contribute, you could call it a bounty if you want, but to incentivize the trappers getting out and getting rid of this nuisance, you know, and the problem is, of course, the beaver hides are not worth what they used to be. People don't have beaver hats anymore, so it's a supplement to make the good thing happen. But you're not open to that in the regions. You can't be a part of the management.
To answer your question, I think I'd have to go back to the development of a market. And I think that we can create a market. We've tested it in Santa Fe, which is the largest Indian market.
Right. Thank you.
So I think the market is there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator French?
I do. Thanks, Madam Chair. We are. This is an area that's covered by federal law, and obviously the question I think that we're struggling with is how do we increase the number of sea otters that can be legally taken by natives for subsistence purposes. That's the realistic solution to the problem. What is holding you back, and by you I mean the native individuals that you're in contact with, what is holding them back from taking more sea otters?
First of all, a couple of things. One, it is costly to go out and to hunt. And we've introduced in federal legislation a subsistence support production program that would help hunters for food security, to help them offset the price of their oil. But for us, I think our program does offer a potential solution. If we can accept that the scientific numbers say that we could harvest an additional 1,300 sea otter in our waters, then I think if we had a little more support in our program, then we would be able to target those kind of areas where it is abundant.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you. The next person signed up to testify is Greg Brown. Welcome, Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much.
Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Greg Brown. I live out here at T. Harbor in Juneau, Alaska. The future of the shellfish industry does not really look good. It has nothing to do with sea otters. It has to do with ocean acidification and the loss of ability to calcify their shells. This is not the first issue that's ever come up with sea otters around the world. In fact, there are dozens of them. And here's the solutions that the Southern California had and how they resolved it. They had all the same issues that we have, and they decided to embrace sea otters as opposed to going out and doing the other killing sea otters. And what they found is they were able to grow their business to $150 million business, which is what it is today. In the city of Santa Barbara alone, they employ over 988 people in the sea otter business. They, in their financial report, which just came out not long ago, they said for every dollar they lost in the shellfish industry, they got $2 back in the viewing industry, which is a pretty good investment. Today, viewing is a $50 billion industry in the United States. It's growing 6% a year, and if you look back on it, it's totally recession-proof. It didn't see the 2006-2007 issues whatsoever. So the solution that I'm proposing, because this shellfish business is not going to grow, just go through the science and look at the calcification issue, is that we ought to be looking at putting a bill together to either buy out the shell fishermen or help them transition to a maritime industry with a growth future. If you look at this industry, I did computer analysis on it last night of what it's going to look like in 24 years. At best, it's going to be flat. And if we compare that to the wildlife viewing industry, today it's a $600 million industry in Alaska, and it'll be well over $2 billion in 24 years. So there is a growth industry for us. If you vote for SB 60, we'll be just be back here in a few years saying there are not enough shellfish, and the bounty should be raised to $500. With SB 60, eventually the people in the shellfish industry will endure just a long, agonizing economic death, just the way the buggy whip people did in the first 30 years of the 1900s. If you choose to rewrite this bill to be constructive, then a lot of nice people in the shellfish industry will have a job in a growth industry in the maritime industry and will be creating wealth to support their families and communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions?
Senator
French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, you bring some unusual qualifications, I think, to your perspective on the economic advantages of wildlife viewing over harvesting. Could you just talk about that background for a minute or so? I know we're in a bind here for time, but I think your resume speaks to the credibility, your credibility on this issue.
Okay, I'll keep it very short. For most of my career, I ran billion-dollar corporations. I was president and CEO of those. I did that through Siemens. You might have heard of Siemens. I ran their largest North American business, Schneider, which is the largest electrical business in the world. I ran their Latin America and their Canadian businesses. And I decided to retire a few years back and move to beautiful Juneau, Alaska, which I'm very pleased I did. So I've been around the economics and the financials of these things for years. I run a business called Weather Permitting Alaska. It's an environmental investment business. And we invest in alternative energy and other things. We have a little small piece of business that we, less than 2% of our assets in a whale watching business, because I like to go out and watch whales, and we take customers and other people out with that. So I'm actively involved with that. I will tell you from the whale watching business and the viewing business, that is one of the most incredible little businesses I've ever seen. We have an 80% ROI in that business. It's and the growth is incredible. We're booked all the time. So it's something that I think is very viable. But I know the shellfish people would be interested in staying, I think, in the maritime industry, so they have the commercial fishing business. But the wildlife viewing, that's one of the fastest-growing businesses in the world. Growth 6% through the recession. Find another business that does that. Not many.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dyson.
Thank you.
When you said, I think, $600 million from the viewing industry, was that cruise ships?
That's everything.
Okay, thank you.
That includes Denali. It's about $300 million down here. Denali's about $200 million, about $100 million in the Kenai. Rough numbers.
And the implication was that our commercial fishermen that here could all transfer and learn to take out tourists and make as much or more money?
Only the shell fishermen am I proposing that, not the commercial finfish industry. Yeah. The shell fishermen could do that, and it's also be a great native industry.
Okay.
Tourists love to come in here and go out with real natives who understand the land and can share those experiences with them.
Thank you.
Not somebody from Bahamas that comes up here and spends a weekend as a naturalist or a summer as a naturalist.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
The next person signed up is Jerry McCune.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent Cordova District Fishermen United. I'm going to come from a little bit different angle. I appreciate the senator bringing this issue up. Maybe a bounty isn't the way to go, but at least we're going to have the issues on the table. Prince William Sound, after the oil spill, the sea otters have really rebounded big time. And I've been on the water for over, probably tell my age here, 50 years. I've been fishing on the water. I've seen a lot of changes over those 50 years, and the sea otters are just continuing to multiply. And my problem is with the federal agency. I've been requesting a population assessment for years with those guys. Because what happens, as soon as that population drops down a little bit, they don't have the numbers to say this is where it should be. And then you get right into the Marine Protection Act, and then you're in all kinds of trouble. That's what happened to Lucian's Islands. They just didn't have any information on it, and so it went on. It's been on. They've been on the endangered list. I can guarantee you they're not endangered in Prince William Sound. I can run 20 minutes from the Cordova Harbor out to Egg Island. There's 1,200 of them. Counted them last year. So I'm not blaming all the problems on sea otters. The earthquake had a lot of things to do with raising the land, water temperature. There's all kinds of things. But we haven't had a WGS fishery for a long time. And I can tell you, the little crabs go into the shallows, they can eat them fast. And you go out to the beaches on the islands, and the shells are half a foot deep from sea otters. And what happens, the sea otters, once they eat themselves out of an area, they move. And now you see them in the ocean, where I never seen them before when I was a kid. They are on the move down towards Yakutat and that way. They never were out there before. They were just in Prince William Sound. There was enough food and there wasn't that many of them to survive. But they need a lot of food to survive, and I'm not advocating that we kill off all kinds of sea otters, but I would like to push on the agencies, federal agencies, to do a better job of not protecting but also managing and looking at these things. And I think in this conversation we need to push them into taking population counts and see where we're at. If they're at the all-time high, I think they're at their all-time high right now in Prince William Sound, Madam Chair. And I take a little bit of exception with the shellfish industry. It is still a viable industry to crab fishing down in southeast here. It has crashed in Yakutat and that way, and the Bering Sea is still thriving, which is very deep. So sea otters have a hard time getting that down that deep. But
I'll have you wrap up, Mr. McKeon.
Okay, I think there's room for both. And I think this conversation is very useful to all of us here.
Questions for Mr. McKeon? Could I just ask you one question? Do you support or oppose the piece of legislation? I wasn't clear on that.
That's a good question, Madam Chair. It doesn't look like it's legal, but it, like I said, it's brought up the conversation. I don't have any one way or the other, but okay. I don't think we're going to be able to do it. So that way, but it's brought all these other things in that we could probably incorporate into some solution here.
All right. Thank you very much. Next person is Tina Brown. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Tina M. Brown. I live here in Juneau. I'll summarize many points. Sea otters are a keystone species. They're necessary for a healthy nearshore ecosystem, not only for many species, including some sea mammals and birds, but for finfish, including salmon and herring. Because of the near extirpation of sea otters in the Russian fur trade, no one alive today has seen a healthy Southeast Alaska nearshore ecosystem. You're hearing perspectives from many people, but they haven't seen a healthy nearshore ecosystem. This was confirmed by sea otter biologists, all of them. When sea otters are present, urchin numbers are controlled, and so kelps flourish. Providing habitat for, as I said, fishes, marine birds, mammals, and the finfish industry can actually benefit from the presence of sea otters. Sea otters also reduce greenhouse gases, which benefits us all. Sea otters have a narrow, limited home range. Unsupervised take, like this bounty proposes, could cause unsustainability. Southeast population, we don't know if it's an optimum sustainable population. It may even be a candidate for depleted under the MMPA right now. And Fish and Wildlife is doing studies. They're doing all of this work. The Sea Otter Symposium last February 21st brought all of that out. Sea otter numbers in the Aleutians are low. It's irresponsible to encourage take in those areas. SB 60 disregards the large and growing tourism industry. Sea otter viewing is popular and lucrative. Allen Marine and Sitka started out with sea otter viewing. This bill is getting negative attention nationwide already. It seems to support circumventing the MMPA for predator control. This doesn't go over well anywhere. Alaska already has a tarnished image. Enforcement would be illegal. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have your written testimony, actually, in our packet. So thanks so much.
Because my written testimony was for the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. This was personal testimony.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Last person signed up is Kathy, or excuse, signed up in this room is Kathy Hansen.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Hansen, and I'm the Executive Director for Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance. We very much appreciate the conversation that the introduction of this bill has allowed to have, particularly some of the testimony provided by the Department of Fish and Game. You can look at this in a couple ways. The way I see this legislation as possibly a way to help manage the ecosystem and shellfish and maintain a sustainable shellfish industry and sea otters in Southeast Alaska. If you let sea otters continue to go the way that they normally do, they will expand into an area really quickly, huge growth population, and then they starve themselves out. At the point when they do that, you have also pretty much killed off all your shellfish resources in the area. When I first started getting into this 10 years ago when I started CIFA, talked to Fish and Wildlife, and they basically said, well, they'll grow, you know, they'll die off. We'll come out with a equalized, you know, stabilized sea otter population. And I said, and what about the shellfish resources? Oh, they'll probably need to be listed on the Endangered Species Act. That's where a lot of commercial fishermen are concerned about. It's not that we want to totally do away with every single sea otter. What we want to do is find a nice level where subsistence users, commercial fishermen, and everybody that likes to eat shellfish has an opportunity to do that, as well as view sea otters. And I know my 1 minute is probably past. Thank you.
Great. Questions for Ms. Hansen? Did you have a question, Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just had a thought. I believe that the previous lady testified that we don't have a baseline of how many sea otters were ever here. It's not a challenge. I don't have time to look at it right now, but if somebody wanted to go find and do a little history project and see what the Russian-American company shipping logs had for information, there's a good baseline, and I think they probably exist, to how many pelts were taken back.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I believe that project, I know the one Fish and Wildlife biologist was trying to find funding to do exactly that, and have somebody go through all the Russian records and figure out exactly where they were located in Southeast Alaska.
Further questions for Ms. Hansen? Thank you for your testimony. And we have one last person signed up in the Petersburg LIO. Matt Warhatch is in Petersburg. Mr. Warhatch, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Max Warhatch, and I'm a commercial fisherman here in Petersburg, and I strongly support this bill as a positive way the state can address the impact of otter predation on valuable state resources. I've been a Dungeness fisherman for over 20 years, and I've seen firsthand what otter predation can do to productive crab grounds. The economic loss to our fisheries and communities is very apparent already and will continue unless otters are managed to a population that allows for the state's resources to be protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Warhatch. Questions? Any committee members for Mr. Warhatch? All right. And that concludes the list of folks that were signed up to testify. So at this point, I will close public testimony. Senator Stedman, would you like to make any closing remarks related to the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Bert Stedman, representing District Q, which is mainly coastal southeast and frankly, the vast majority of southeast, most of the areas affected within this region. I recognize that there are some legal issues possibly to work on and review, which I'm looking forward to. Hopefully, I'll be able to do that in front of the Judiciary Committee. That would be a good forum. I also recognize that this is the beginning, early stages of the discussion of this item, and look forward to any changes or amendments, recommendations that the committee wants to put forward. But I think it's timely that the state of Alaska stands up for the people in the state. And this issue has been festering for almost a decade. It's getting to the point where a lot of our residents in the outlying communities are suffering. We've heard from earlier testimony from the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation that there's interest in creating products, and they're having problems doing that, as referenced by significantly altered, you know, a hat. I've heard even you can't even put a zipper in a vest. Things of that. So there's areas that can be broadened out and worked on in the future in the discussion, hopefully, with the judiciary review. And I just urge the Resources Committee to consider this bill in the best interest of the region and the state for further discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Stedman? Senator Machicki.
I actually just wanted to make a comment and thank you for opening up the discussion. I mean, I you know, this is a real issue. And it's not just an economic issue. It's social, cultural, and nutritional issue. I know, speaking for South Central Alaska, the changes in 30 years from what was available to families there that count on mollusks and crustaceans that have literally disappeared is a real issue. And I appreciate you bringing it up. It's a great way to get some attention and start a very serious discussion about a plan forward for Alaskans. The problem I have is how quickly folks are willing to write off commercial fisheries for people that have been involved for generations in harvesting our seafood and getting it to market. Very much support the visiting industry, but we have to keep an eye open for Alaska's fishing families as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to identify with the remarks of the previous speaker here. I think we all have to think about sometime or another how do we rank different industries and ways of making money. And to me, providing good food outranks providing good entertainment. And I think that's a very valid perspective. And so somebody that does something that's useful to mankind is, to me, a more valid industry than somebody that makes life more fun, more satisfying. And I enjoy both. I suspect, Senator Stedman, your bill might do better if it was ranked as a subsidy for enabling people to get sea otters to be transferred to people who can make very useful things and so on. But you don't need my advice. But I do think that Senator Stedman is correct that a Judiciary Committee is the place to look at the legality of the issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
If I could, Madam Chairman, I do hear that advice and take that advice seriously, Senator Dyson. I think the term bounty is, you know, has visions of, you know, wild and crazy people out just shooting everything that floats. That is not what we want to talk about. It's not what we want to do. We're not interested in eradication. So I think maybe as this bill goes forward, thought of recrafting maybe the verbiage a little bit or something would get it a little more on point and keep the sensationalism off the table so we can try to come up with a solution.
Further questions or comments for this bill sponsor? Senator French.
I feel like the bill's about to leave the committee, and instead of objecting to it leaving and voting, I'll just say I appreciate your remarks, Senator Stedman. I think you recognize and the committee recognizes that this approach is not going to work. It's not legal. But I think there is some way to work with the Native community to perhaps help them with their fuel costs or help them, you know, harvest more sea otters legally. And I wish you all the best success in crafting that compromise bill to this one.
Thank you. All right. So, Senator Dyson, the will of the committee?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 60, bounty on sea otters, onto the next committee of referral with individual recommendations. And I believe a zero fiscal motive, I remember.
Actually, $28,000.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the other one. All right, with attached fiscal note.
Very good. Any objections? All right. With that, Senate Bill 60 will move to the next committee of referral, which is Judiciary, and then it will be followed by Finance, of course, but the next committee is Judiciary. All right. So we'll hold signing that document until the end of the committee meeting today. The next bill that's up before the committee tonight is Senate Bill 69, Chinook Research and Restoration Endowment. We closed public testimony, heard public testimony last meeting, and closed public testimony. I understand we may have an amendment from a committee member. Senator Machicki.
I do have an amendment, Madam Chair. I don't remember the way to make an amendment, but...
Just make a motion to move amendment number one.
That's what I'd like to do. I'd like to make a motion to move amendment number one, please.
All right. Is there objection?
Just for explanation purposes.
Very good.
Senator, thank you.
Senator Machicki, would you like to expand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You bet. What the amendment does is on page 5, line 26, following the word board, we'd be inserting the words and the National Fish Habitat Board. We've had some involvement with that board, and the reality of it is there may be some additional funding that the state can take advantage of on the federal level that could sort of supplement some of the investment of the state. If you leave it out, I'm afraid that you might be at risk of compromising some of that funding.
Thank you. Questions?
That's
for Senator Machicki. Yes, Senator French?
Page 5, line 26. If I understand the gist of this provision, it's just simply urging the board to consider the process and structure of the National Pacific Research Board while it's in the process of adopting its own regulations, and you just want them to consider, besides the National Pacific Research Board, you want them to consider the National Fish Habitat Board, the process and structure of that board as well.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
That's correct. On the way the projects are evaluated are actually important on how they rank in the Fish Habitat Board process.
Right.
So if they evaluate them both, they would likely be eligible for the other funding as well.
Is the amendment supported by the bill sponsor?
Senator Machicki?
We have spoken to staff of the sponsor. And they, through the staff, are in support. We've also spoken to the department, who seem to be in support as well.
Very good.
With that, I'll withdraw my objection.
All right. Any further objections? Hearing none, the amendment is adopted. Mr. Stone, would you like to make any closing remarks related to the bill?
For the record, Madam Chair, David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. in regards to the Senator Machicki's amendment, the sponsor of the bill is fully aware that the sponsor of the amendment is a commercial fisherman, and he trusts his judgment on that. And then in closing, I think we summed it up last meeting, and that there's a very real sense across many parts of the state on the question of what's wrong with our king salmon, what's wrong with our Chinook salmon. They come from our rivers, they're our salmon, they are and people are worried, and we're trying to help that out. We're trying to help the people in the state of Alaska get a grip on what's going on with their resource. We're thankful for the committee scheduling the bill.
Very good. Thank you. Any closing questions for Mr. Scott? All right. Seeing none. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My motion is to move SB 69 from committee as amended with fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Very good. Is there any objection? Senator Machicki?
For purpose of just there may be a little discussion to take place in finance about the funding mechanism, and just wanted that for the record.
Of course.
But I'll remove my objection.
Thank you. Yes, of course. All right. Without objection, then, Senate Bill 69, version A, as amended, goes from this committee to the next committee of referral, which is finance. The next bill before us is Senate Bill 59. This bill is an act relating to the approval of oil and gas or gas-only exploration and development in a geographic area. Today we have here with us Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan, as well as Bill Barron, Director of Division of Oil and Gas, and Wendy Wolf from the Division of Oil and Gas. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Sullivan. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, I have with me the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Bill Barron, and Wendy Wolf, who will be providing a detailed PowerPoint that can provide a little bit more information with regard to SB 59. So what I wanted to do, Madam Chair, very quickly was to provide just a quick overview with regard to the bill. And I know that some of you have already seen the overview in the previous committee referral in the TAPS Throughput Committee. And I also know that some of the members and staff have been pre-briefed on this. So what I'd like to do is just go ahead. Thanks. I'll continue here. Just provide a broader context for the bill in two categories, Madam Chair. The first is with regard to obviously one of the biggest issues that the legislature has taken up during this legislative session, which is trying to arrest the TAPS throughput, which we see is really the most urgent issue facing the state economically right now. Madam Chair, as you know, we have testified before this committee a number of times on the state's broader comprehensive strategy with regard to the turning around the TAPS throughput decline. That includes enhancing Alaska's competitiveness across a whole number of areas. In particular, a cornerstone of that we see is tax reform. It also includes promoting Alaska's resources and resource base to companies really throughout the entire world, something that we've also been working on, facilitating and incentivizing the next phases of North Slope development. But, Madam Chair, one of the other key elements of that comprehensive strategy is ensuring a permitting process that's more efficient, more timely, and more certain. And that is what, in many ways, this bill, HB 50 or SB 59, is focused on. And as we've gotten out and talked and spoken to different companies really throughout the country, even throughout the world, the issue of competitiveness, certainly fiscal competitiveness, comes up, but this issue of permitting and the issue of timeliness and certainty of the Alaska's permitting system also comes up. I can give you just recently, Repsol had very senior officials from the company come in from Madrid that were talking about a number of things, but they saw the work that the legislature's taken up with regard to certainly oil taxes, but also the permitting reform, particularly if they're looking to move into development, as really, really important, because in many ways the efficiency of our system doesn't always have such a great reputation, and that's the other feedback we get. And whether that's state or whether that's federal issues that have become highlighted nationally and internationally in terms of delays, it's something that we also recognize that we need to work on. And so, as you know, Madam Chair, one of the other things that we have mentioned and testified in front of this committee previously, we've laid out the comprehensive permitting reform modernization plan over the last couple years. The governor has three bills during this legislative session. One was passed last year, but it includes an entire suite of efforts. And again, it's been a very strong bipartisan support over the last 2 years on the permitting reform and modernization efforts. And this is one of the important elements that the legislature is taking up this year. Madam Chair, I also wanted to mention that whether it's TAPS throughput, whether it's gas line commercialization off the North Slope, whether it's interior energy plan, whether it's Cook Inlet energy issues, whether it's strategic and critical minerals, the work that we're trying to do, and again, very strong bipartisan support from the legislature on permitting reform and modernization, it touches all of those critical interests of the state. And I just wanted to mention one thing. It's also encouraging to see when this administration, when the legislature acts on some of these issues, that you do see the competitiveness of Alaska start to be highlighted and improved. And I'll give one example that it's a kudos to Senator Bishop, certainly, but last week we put out a press release, the Fraser Institute, that does an annual survey of mining competitiveness. We've mentioned to this committee on some of the federal mining issues where we rank last. This Fraser Institute competitiveness study moved Alaska up in its ranking fairly significantly for two major reasons. The statewide mineral assessment that we are currently undertaking right now, that again was a budget item from the legislature, and the significant improvements they've seen in labor and skill force training in the mining sector, which Senator Bishop had a lot to do with. So it's a good example of where, when we're working together trying to improve our competitiveness, people are noticing. So just two final comments, Madam Chair, then, and then Bill and Wendy will go into more detail, is the issue of certainly we want to maintain the highest standards that we think we have. We think we have some of the highest standards in the world with regard to protecting the environment, encouraging responsible development. We don't believe that this or any of the governor's bills diminish from that. There's also been the issue of public input, and we think that, as you know, Madam Chair, this goes to the issue of leases that have already been determined through best interest findings that there's going to be oil and gas development. The leases have already been issued. So that lease process, the best interest findings, there is an enormous public input process to go into leasing, to put leases out for companies to bid. So this is into the next stage, as Wendy and Bill will talk a little bit more in more detail about. But we believe that what this is trying to do, where you have public input at the beginning of exploration phases, in the beginning of development phases, in many ways is more meaningful than at the smaller points throughout each of the phases. And we also believe that this brings certainty to exploration and development, which is not only good for the public to know what's happening, but it does encourage more investment, and it's good with regard to industry's outlook on developing responsible resource development in the state. And finally, Madam Chair, one other issue. We just testified a couple hours ago in front of House Resources on the companion bill. Representative Hawker brought up a really good point that I just wanted to mention here in this hearing. If you look at DNR's statutes presently, there's a pretty strong argument that we already have the authority to do this. And as we were looking at this, and Bill can explain it in a little bit more detail, it wasn't clear. Some people thought we did. Others thought it was more of a close call. And so we thought what the most prudent way, in many ways respect to the legislative body, was to come here and make it 100% clear through passing legislation that if we move in this direction, we have 100% the authority from the legislative branch, and that will, from our perspective, obviate the need to probably go to court and defend something like this. Because if there was uncertainty, we didn't think it would be in the state's interest to not have either the administration or the legislature decide it. It would be decided by the third branch of government, which is, you know, in Alaska, a good branch, but we didn't want to put it in the judiciary's hands. So that's the reason why we've come to the legislature to make it clear that we have this authority. But again, Representative Hawker raised a good point saying, hey, you might already have it. We think that's a close question, but we thought the more prudent approach was to make it 100% clear from a legislative enactment that we do have that authority. So, Madam Chair, that's my overview presentation. If there are any questions on broader issues, I'd be glad to entertain them. Otherwise, we can move directly into Bill and Wendy's more specific briefing that I think provides a pretty good explanation of exactly what the bill is trying to do.
Very good. Questions for the commissioner? Senator Bishop.
Briefly, can't let you get away without a question. Good to see you, Commissioner. Because I'm going to have to leave if we're not done by 5 at a finance meeting. But just real briefly, if you can answer it. If not, that's fine, too. I know it's early in the process, but I know you, and I know you've probably thought about this. Can you give me a range on
if this legislation was to pass, what's the gap we would close up on the permitting time?
So through the chair, Senator Bishop, I can let Wendy and Bill talk to that a little bit more. What it does, it closes up times in terms of public notice and comment, but so there's certain windows, right? 30 days, 60 days that are required presently. But it also, it's important, and a lot of our permitting reform efforts are focused on, remember, every one of these comments has the state responding to them, which is fine. That's what we're supposed to be doing. But also, it can bring changes to plans, right, in the middle of the plan. And what we're trying to do is have a very comprehensive public input process up front at the exploration phase and the development phase with very specific parameters within those plans that are approved by public notice, public comment, by the public, and then we move forward in a way that everybody knows where the certainty is. So, Senator Bishop, I think we can give you kind of, hey, exactly this 30-day period or this 90-day period, but we think it might have a lot more of a positive impact than just the specific window of days that are being removed by certain public comment and notice periods that are now being removed for each stage.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Further questions for the Commissioner? All right.
Thank you very much,
Commissioner. So next we'll welcome Director Bill Barron, Division of Oil and Gas, and his assistant Wendy Wolf. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Bill Barron, and I'm the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. And I would just like to start off besides saying that the Commissioner is actually listening to the testimony we've given before, because he's getting really good at taking some of my best points. The other thing is an amazing observation of the process that we've just gone through. I repeatedly tell my staff that I sit in awe when I leave Juneau, and it's because this committee is a perfect example of how we have had discussions of frankenfish, shellfish, otters, and now oil and gas. And for you to be able to comprehend and understand some very complicated issues associated with each one of those individual industries and peoples is a testimony to not only your service, but your desire to do the right thing for the state. And I just had to say that. It's just an amazing thing to watch.
Called pandering.
No, it's not, Senator. And you know that. And if it were, I would do it better. But what we're doing here in the Senate Bill 59 is we have tried over the last specifically several years to take a real hard look at issues and processes that we can make modifications to in our process in the Division of Oil and Gas to encourage dialogue, encourage transmission of information and data between the public sector and the private sector and the citizens of the state and the administration of the land management issues. And that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out another tool in our toolbox to manage state land. And one of the common themes that we heard, and specifically we heard it in several discussions with North Slope Borough, was we really want to understand not project by project what's happening. We want to understand on a broader basis, on a holistic basis, what is going to happen in an area, in a geographic area. And in that regard, that's kind of where we sat back and said, how can we do this? And it's very similar. We've sort of taken a page out of our playbook from area-wide lease sales, where we went through a robust public discussion and identified lands that were going to be made available for state leasing, state lands for leasing, and a tremendous public input and a best interest finding that said these areas are right and should be developed for oil and gas. So we now understand that it's not will this land be developed. It's really now a question of how to develop it. So the next logical step is to take a look at the next phase, and that next phase is truly the exploration and then the development, and trying to identify in smaller areas than the area-wide leasing, smaller areas for exploration, and even further smaller areas for development, what activities will take place, let the public engage up front with a better, broader understanding of the activities that could take place and probably will take place, and let them identify areas of concerns, and then let the division bring up and identify mitigation issues and standards that the companies then would address. This is not necessarily something we would do across all the lands. We would have the discretion of saying this area is critical, it's crucial. We may not even use it for certain areas because we want more public engagement. It's just a tool that we would have available to us. So that's it's another 30,000 foot way of trying to explain what we're doing, and I'll pass the ball to Wendy. But at the discretion of the committee and the Madam Chairman, Wendy does have a really good presentation. It's about 10 minutes long. If we could hold questions, I would appreciate that, and that way some of the questions you have might actually be answered as we go through the presentation. But then after that, we would be more than happy to answer anything. So with that.
Great.
Okay,
wonderful.
Thank you. I'm Wendy Wolf. I work with the Division of Oil and Gas. What I'm going to go through is how we approve exploration and development activities today and how this bill will change those, the process for approving exploration and development. I'll start with how we lease, how we offer lands for sale. We have 5 oil and gas lease sales in the state, and the first lease sale area I'm showing you is the North Slope. So what we do is we do a best interest finding that Bill discussed. So the 5 areas are the North Slope, then you have the Beaufort Sea, which is offshore, you have the foothills, North Slope foothills, and then there's the Cook Inlet area and the Alaska Peninsula. So those are the area-wide lease sale areas that this bill is addressing. It's not addressing other areas, it's the lease sale areas themselves. So those are your geographic areas to keep in mind throughout this presentation. Okay. So what Senate Bill 59 does is it takes the statutory requirement to provide a public notice at the beginning of each phase of a multi-phase project and clarifies that the Department of Natural Resources can review the phase in a geographical area. And in this context, project is the individual, is not the individual activity on the land. Project is oil and gas development in general, because the project is the lease sale area. The best interest finding said we're going to do a multi-phase project review, the first phase being the lease disposal phase, the second phase being exploration, the second and the third one being development, and the last one is actually transportation, which is the pipelines. And so that's what, when I'm using the word project in this context, it's a general project, not a site-specific project. And so the initial leasing phase is when we do our best interest finding, and this is when we decide that oil and gas development will occur in an area. The question then becomes how will oil and gas development will occur, and that's done through the exploration phase decisions and the development. So what this bill does is it allows us to take a look at a broader geographical area when we're evaluating exploration and development, and it will not change how we evaluate transportation. Okay, so how does this benefit the public? It'll allow the public to look at exploration and development across the broader geographic area and provide input about how particular areas should be developed before the development occurs. So when you define a geographical area, they can identify their concerns at the beginning before they're responding to a project or a specific activity that's in their neighborhood. They can alert us to those issues ahead of time. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped ahead of myself. I apologize. I'll backtrack just for a moment. I've repeated what both Bill and the commissioner says. It's clarifying that we can look at things across a broad geographic area. That's what the bill does. And then how industry benefits is that they know when they're designing their site-specific activities and coming forward with their plan of operation what parameters they need to operate under. And so they can expect predictable results when they submit a plan of operation that's in compliance with not only the least mitigation measures that come out in a best interest finding, but in compliance with an exploration decision that says these are the parameters under which you can explore. In the event that there is a project that doesn't meet the parameters, then we would go out for a public notice at that time because it doesn't comply with the parameters, either the mitigation measures that were in the lease sale or the parameters of a decision under this statute, or bill, I should say. So I'm going to go briefly through the best interest finding. As the director said, it's a broad public process that we go through when we're doing a best interest finding for one of these large geographic areas. And in the best interest finding, there's extensive public participation, agency participation, both at the federal, state, and local levels. And they evaluate the impacts associated with oil and gas development based on statutory criteria. And the resulting decision has concrete mitigation measures that the operators who are successful in acquiring leases in the area must comply with. It also says that they're doing a multi-phase project review so that it is only addressing the leasing phase, and that before the subsequent phases are approved, that we would do a public notice and opportunity to comment. And those phases by statute are defined as exploration, development, and transportation. So I'll go a little bit through how the process works today and how we've implemented that requirement. And what the department has done to implement that requirement is that we've taken the requirement to look at, to provide public notice and opportunity to comment at the beginning of an exploration or development phase down to a site-specific activity on a lease-by-lease basis from a particular operator. That's how we've chosen to implement it. And so the public is accustomed to that. And as there's been discourse about, you know, do we need this or don't we need this, it's probably more a result of the fact that this is how we've been operating on a site-specific basis, because we always get plans of operation, and the lease requires a plan of operation to be approved before the operator can proceed with those plans of operation. So we've chosen to use that as the step to do a public notice at. And so what happens is the lease is disposed of in the lease sale, and then the lessee will come in probably a few years later with a seismic program, and that may go across multiple leases. They'll come in with their plan of operation for their seismic program, and then we would go out to public notice with comment and come up with approval for their seismic program and include any special stipulations that might be necessary. Then if they're successful with that, they'll come in with their next plan of operation for an exploration well, and again, we'll go out with a public notice with an opportunity to comment and issue the approval for the plan of operation for exploration. If they want to come in with another exploration plan, another exploration well, even in the same lease, same operator, we'll go out again for another public notice with an opportunity to comment before we approve the plan of operation. If they're successful and they have a discovery, they'll come in and describe their conceptual development plans, but then it will be at the point that they come in with their actual plan of development for their initial development that will go out with the public review. And after that public comment period and we've approved that plan, if they come in and they say, you know what, we need to modify our plan, and we're going to move the pad and the well, and we're modifying our plan, well, then we'll go out with another public notice, even though we're still in the same area being developed, and we'll do a public notice with the opportunity comment before we approve the modified plan. When they come in with their pipeline application, that will continue to be a separate process. It's dealt with under different statute, and that won't change. So there will still be public notice and opportunity to comment during the pipeline. Now, if they're successful and they want to have enhanced recovery or additional development, even in the same lease of a fully developed lease, we're going to go out with another public comment period if they're going to put a satellite pad in. If the adjoining lease, the operator comes in and they say, you know what, I'm going to come in now and I want to put a well in here. It's an exploration well. We'll start the process over again. Even though the lease to the north is in full development, we will come in with the exploration plan and go out for a public notice on the plan of operation. Likewise, if they have the second well, we'll do it again. And then when they come in with development, again, we will go out for a public notice with an opportunity to comment before we approve the plan of operation. And as I said, the transportation will continue to be noticed separately. So that's kind of how the process works today. It's very redundant in the sense that when you're in a small geographic area, if you're in a totally separate area, no, it's not redundant. But when you're talking about a geographic area where there is activity going on, it's nice to be able to look at something much more holistically than to focus on each individual project. And the public has, in the past, wanted to know more about what's happening before they even provide comments for the first plan, because they're saying, well, this plan might be okay, but I might not like the next plan. And when can I tell you this? And we can say, well, not now, because we don't know what the next plan is. But this way they can look at something more holistically. So when we're defining geographical areas, for exploration, the area is going to be smaller than the area-wide lease sale boundary, but it's going to be larger than an individual lease. And so in areas that have a lot of exploration or development activity going on, an exploration area may be much larger. But in areas that have other concerns, we may be smaller. In the Kenai, there may be smaller exploration areas than up on the slope. So here are some hypothetical examples of exploration areas. So you may have an exploration area that kind of incorporates all of the actively producing units on the North Slope. And it may be separate from the area to the south that is the shale oil area. It hasn't matured yet. We haven't gotten any exploration. I shouldn't say we haven't had any exploration, but it's not developed yet. And so the considerations may be different. Likewise, the considerations on the eastern portion of the North Slope may be different. So exploration areas will be defined based on the particular geography and what's happening already up in that area. And the kind of activity that we're talking about for exploration on the North Slope would be activity that occurs off ice roads and ice pads, portable drilling equipment, and that's temporary in nature. They're in and out in a season or two. But for development, when you're talking about development, now you're talking about gravel facilities. They're going to be there for a while, and so it's going to be more focused. And so we may have a development area that is a group of leases that an operator wants to develop collectively. It may be an existing unit where we go and say, in this unit, we are authorizing development in the entire unit, as opposed to what's happened so far is the area that has a pad and where they're developing is authorized. Any new pad within a unit would go out for public notice. Or it may be an area that takes in the core part of our legacy fields. We haven't made this decision. These are just hypothetical examples. But let's focus on a small area that's kind of sandwiched in between all of this existing development. And so what would happen after SB 59 passed? We would still have our best interest finding and with the mitigation measures that are on there. Then we would come out and define a geographic area and the allowable uses that we would propose in that exploration phase. Things like they can do ice roads, they can do ice pads, they need to be this size, they can have camps that are this large, things like that. And then we would go out with a public notice describing all of that, and the public would have the opportunity to weigh in on the geographic area, and they can come in and tell us what their concerns are very specifically for that area. Or if there's a type of activity that we're proposing, they can come in and say, I'm really okay with everything, but not with this particular type of activity. And then the department would have to take all of that into consideration. And we would come out with our decision. Then after we've come out with our decision, this is kind of hard to see on this slide, but the public notices for the individual plans of operation, once we've made the approval decision for the exploration phase, would not be necessary unless the plan of operation was not in compliance with the exploration phase decision or mitigation measures, or there was some other reason that the department didn't felt that a public notice was important. The under SB 59, we would still, as we do today, have agency review. That doesn't change. So even though the plan of operation won't go out for a public notice, there will be agency review. Then for the development phase, again, we'd go through a public notice period. We'd describe the activities. Now we're talking about a more finite area. We can do the phase analysis when we have a conceptual plan of development, when an operator comes in with a plan for a particular area, or we may choose to do these in areas where we have existing units, and we may just unilaterally go across and do each of our individual units after working with the operators and saying, what are your plans for the areas that you don't currently have any surface activity? Where are you going, and how are you going to finish the development of this field? And so then we'd go out with the development phase decision, lay that all out, provide an opportunity for comment, and then when they actually implement their plan of operation, which is what we've agreed that they can do, then the subsequent public notices won't occur. Agency review will continue to occur, and the pipeline applications will continue to have their separate public notices. So it's important to remember that the plans of operation are not automatically approved by these phasing decisions. We are required to review them, make sure they're in compliance with the regulations and the mitigation measures. And when our sister agencies give us comments, and we need to take that all into consideration. Part of what these decisions will allow the operators to do is to plan ahead of time. And hopefully, by the time we get the plans of operation, there aren't going to be those concerns because they would have already addressed them in their plan. So how does it look at the end of the day? Let's take our little geographical area that was in our circle, and the department would come out and with their exploration phase decision with a public notice and opportunity to comment. We'd go through the process, come up with the special stipulations parameters that they can develop, and then when they come in with their particular plans of operation for the for their exploration phase, those pieces can go through without public notice. They will still require the approvals, but they don't require the public notice. Then when we get to the next step and there's going to be development in this area, again, we'll go out with a decision for the development phase, outlining all the criteria and the parameters. But then once we've gotten through that process, each individual plan of operation that's implementing the development plan can proceed without the additional public notices. Now, as always, anytime we have changes or we have concerns that maybe we didn't consider in the phase analysis when we first did it, we can always go out with individual public notices for any of the plans of operation. This is just a tool that we can use. It's not a requirement, so it doesn't prevent us from going out individually. And the other, and then here I'll put my little pipelines in, and those will continue through with the their separate notices. But the time savings, more than the savings to the state, we believe it will save the company's time. Because what happens now is we may go out for an agency review and then the public notice and we have comments and then we say to the companies, these are the concerns and we want you to address these concerns. And so for us, maybe that was 30 or 60 days, but then the company, it might be 6 months before we hear back from them because they've now had to modify their plans and incorporated whatever those concerns were. And so what we're trying to do is provide certainty for everybody, for the public and for the industry going into it. And the industry can also then at the beginning say, I can't comply with this. And we'll say, well, then we're going to have to go out with a separate notice, and we're going to have to evaluate what you do want to do and see if we can accommodate it or not. Because this is really about how development occurs on state land. And we have our resource management hat as the state landowner on when we're doing this. It doesn't change any of the other regulatory processes that exist. It doesn't change the opportunity to appeal a decision that we make. So when we approve plans of operation, that's an appealable decision. And so if we've done something in error in our plan of operation approval, somebody can come forth and appeal that. And one thing we're trying to do, and we've been working on how to make those decisions more accessible, they're public, anybody can come in and look at them, but we're trying to make them more accessible so people can find them more easily. So With that, I'll close.
Very good. Questions for Wendy? Yes, Senator French.
Madam Chair, if we could compare slide 6 and slide 9. First, let's look at slide 6. It looks to me like right now, under the current state of affairs and the normal course of a lease and an exploration plan and a development plan, there are 7 opportunities for public notice and comment. I just went through and counted the opportunities. And if I understand slide 9 correctly, this bill would leave us in a position of having 2 opportunities. Is that roughly correct?
That would be correct, but you're omitting the initial opportunity, which is at the best interest decision. And it's important to remember the extensive notices that those go through and the lengthy mitigation measures that are put in place. And an operator, in order to even submit their plan, has to go through each mitigation measure in that area and tell us how they're complying with it.
Okay, and that would be, if we went back to slide 6, that would be something that happened up in the year 0, up before the final finding of the director?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's kind of off the slide. But
And if I may interrupt just for a moment, every year on our best interest findings, we go out for supplemental information, and we go out, that's a public notice, every year in our sale areas. And so every year we say, "What is there new information that you need to provide to us for our best interest finding?" And at that point, the public could come in and say, you know what? There's way too much exploration going on out here. We have concerns, and this is why. And so every year, the public has a bite at the apple for whether we're going to even dispose of the oil and gas interest in that area.
I see.
Follow-up, Senator French?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give me an idea of how, I mean, I understand, and let's use slide 2, actually slide slide 7 is a way to make this point. Slide 7, you have 3 areas. You got to go through each year a little.
Sorry.
She's got to get fully developed.
That's right. First things first.
There we okay. go. Yeah, now we're developed.
Now, the slide that I have in my presentation has 3 big blue. There we go. Perfect. Now, when you... you've issued your best interest finding. You're now going out for exploration and development. How broadly, and let's just use the north slope, the northernmost land-based blue area there, how much area are you covering with the second phase? After the best interest finding is made, and you're telling the public, okay, we're going to start exploration in this area, how much of that area is going to be covered by this? You know, is it 10,000 acres? Is it 1,000 acres? How much?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator French, we really can't answer that question just yet. What we're trying to do is basically put out a systematic approach toward this process. What we fully intend to do is establish those areas through a regulation process. So we would engage the public up front in terms of, and this is for exemplary purposes only. So this would be the 3. Somebody could come in through that process and say, no, I think the lower portion really needs to be broken into 4 other buckets. We could do that. So we want to engage the public. What we're trying to show in conceptual form is the area-wide lease sale is pretty darn big. The exploration area should be not as big, but it should be fairly big because the impacts are ice roads, ice pads, very limited exposure kind of operations. Where we really want to concentrate in is on the development portion. And those areas could be incredibly small. They could be the size of a single unit. So we want to make sure that as we go through this process that we do it intelligently and do it in a way that the public is engaged so that they have a lean in on how big these things are. And they could be different. The slope operations could be much different in size than the operations in Kenai. So again, it's kind of one of those questions that we can't give you an answer because we haven't sat down with the public to say how big or how small should they be.
if I could just follow up.
Yes.
And I think that's going to be a crucial sort of aspect. And you and I spoke about this earlier. I really appreciate your coming to my office and talking to me about this ahead of time, because I think this is going to have some really strong and fantastic applications on the North Slope, where there's few people, you know, few other impacts, where, you know, 95% of the state would say, yes, let's develop this, let's explore this, let's get going here as fast as possible. And I think you're just going to have more conflicts in the Cook Inlet, for example. More people, more users, recreational users, hunting, fishing, and so forth. And so I just, I guess my concern is giving you, you know, a huge new opportunity to develop without that same amount of public input in densely populated areas. I think you're gonna wind up in a friction environment.
Through the chair, Senator French, we greatly appreciate that insight. It's something that we did consider as we went through this process. And there's a lot of times where, even today, when somebody comes in with an amendment to their plan, there are times where the amendment is so great that we've said, no, we're going to go back out to the public and say, this is a significant change. An operation that they said was going to take 7 days, they now want to do for 180 days. No, the public needs to be involved in those kind of decisions, and you know, that would still be the practice of the division. What we're trying to do is, in multi-use areas, we may choose not to do it. Kenai would be a good example. The east side of Kenai, or the peninsula, may not be a place that we want to take this operation on. The west side, which is a less dense population, a little bit more open, this would be a great tool to use. So, again, what we're trying to establish is the authority to have the tool in our toolbox and then use the discretion of the division when to implement that tool.
Very good. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, just caution you not to use the word Kenai too broadly. Middle of the inlet, something like that, be a perfect application. But, you know, in many cases I've seen spot permitting that doesn't take a larger area into account. I think this is a safer way to understand the larger environmental community impacts. Anyway, I like that part of it. I like the more holistic 30,000-foot view and then drilling down for the individual impact. So I also like that it's separated in phases, and I think the public's going to be a lot more comfortable knowing it does require a new evaluation for significant scope or impact changes. So part I like the best about it is efficiency. If you're doing the same thing, it's not only more efficient for human resources at the department, but also for NGOs and individuals as well, looking at a larger area.
Through the chair, yes, sir. We believe that's correct.
Great. Could I ask you, Director Varin, feel like you have this authority already, but you want it clarified in statute? Have you been operating under this method at all? Even though you felt you had the authority, were you doing this?
Madam Chairman, no, actually we were doing exactly as Wendy had described, and that is the public process at every step.
Okay.
It's kind of one of those, some people think we have it, some people think we don't, and we're just kind of in that point where we're saying, you know, we really agonized on whether to bring this bill forward. Because there was that strong tension between them. We finally resolved at the commissioner's level and some very good dialogue that, no, we really want, you know, we are the administrators of statute, and we wanted to make sure that we understood clearly what this body wanted us to do and how this body wanted us to operate with very clear direction. And that's why we came forward with the bill to make sure that we were clear about that and that the citizens of Alaska knew that was the direction that this body would like.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Great. We do have a person signed up here in the room to testify, so we'll go ahead and take that testimony. James Sullivan has signed up to speak on the bill. So thank you very much, Director and Ms. Wolf. Welcome, Mr. Sullivan. I'll give you 2 minutes of testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, my name is James Sullivan. I'm with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. I've had the opportunity to see Ms. Wolf's presentation now in three committees. And I know that each time that our Commissioner Sullivan has spoken, he's used the word certainty over and over again, and that's what they're hoping to accomplish here. Yet through each time here that I listen to the presentation, I become more uncertain with how this is actually going to affect such large portions of our state. I'm particularly confused on how, when they put in this development stage, I think it's very problematic that we get the one opportunity to comment, and then if they make a modification within this small geographic area, we're not given the opportunity to comment on the changes, as we currently are allowed, I believe, in statute, that they'll decide if it's a big enough decision or a big enough change to warrant that within these geographic areas. I also find it difficult because I can't, you know, and I'm fully willing to admit that maybe I'm just too dim to understand what's going on, but these changes that are occurring or these geographic areas as they're going to be applied in particularly the Cook Inlet and how they're going to develop these at the development stage, I think it's very problematic that these aren't set out in statute already, that they, and I've just heard Director Barron say, well, we might use it and we might not. They could be large areas, they could be very small, they could be designated as a unit. And as I keep hearing him as he explains all this, it seems that certainty is not what it's all about. And I think that it, because it causes this uncertainty in my mind, we're having a lot of trouble getting behind this bill and supporting it. As I've talked with other organizations, we find it very problematic, the course they're taking. I'll leave it at that for now.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sullivan. And there's no one else signed up online. All right, great. We'll close public testimony then. And we're going to hold this bill over for a future hearing. It's noticed for next Wednesday because next Monday at our meeting, we're going to be reviewing the governor's appointees for the Big Game Commercial Services Board and also the Board of Fisheries, so we can pass those along to the joint session for confirmation. So at this time, we'll adjourn this meeting. Let the record reflect that it is 5:03 p.m. Thank you.